Well, even if you aren't a gourmet chef, chances are that you can read a food menu and zero in on things that you'll enjoy and ingredients that you know you're going to like to eat. A lot of people get a lot more nervous when it comes to the wine list and trying to figure out how to choose the right bottle to go with a meal, and one that's not going to break the bank. So we're lucky because back again, Jessica Bell, she is here to help us decipher wine choices and how to know if it's good or a great list. She's the founder and CEO of My Wine School. It's based in Chicago and Milwaukee. And Jessica, it's great to have you back.
Great to be back, Larry. Thanks.
You look different.
I do. I'm a little flatter. I'm not pregnant anymore. I think the last couple segments we were talking about non-alcoholic wines and alternatives. I brought the real thing today.
Yeah.
So I brought a wine from Macedonia of all places.
Macedonia. Mm-hmm.
And the grape is actually Vranek, spelled V-R-A-N-E-C. And it's a fantastic wine. Go ahead. It's well, five somewhere, right?
It's five somewhere. I'll take a sip.
I'll let you know why I brought this. This is actually a wine from my sister's butcher shop and restaurant in the Third Ward in Milwaukee. And I brought it because it is an unusual wine, but it's a very reasonably priced wine. So this is one of her least expensive wines on her list, very limited list. It's a small restaurant. But the reason why I brought it is because I feel like if people don't ask about wine lists, they're really missing out. Because people would often steer away from this because they don't recognize the grape or the place, but it's probably the best value wine she has on the list. And I just want
to encourage. Tasty.
Yeah, this is a $32 restaurant wine. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's about as cheap as restaurant wines get. And it's only $32. And it tastes more like a $50 or $60 wine. It's got great structure and tannin and flavor. And I just think a lot of people miss out on great wines because they're afraid to ask. And, what you were referring to earlier, you know, what do you order? Well, I think the first stop is to ask your server, or very few places, I think, in Madison and Milwaukee have dedicated sommeliers, someone who's dedicated just to advising on wine. So in their place, there are hopefully educated servers about their wine lists.
Do you think that the wine lists get a little too large sometimes?
I do. And I think it's fantastic to have a well-curated, extensive wine list, but only if that restaurant can translate that wine list into a favorable and memorable experience. Just to have a showpiece wine list does the diners no good. I've seen so many restaurants where it's 50-page wine list, and I think probably the same 5 or 10 wines sell. So what's the point of having the other ones, right? And I think that responsibility is on the shoulders of the restaurant owners to not only have either a dedicated professional to wine, but also to educate their staff about the wine and keep it reasonable.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. When you've got such a big list, how do the servers? And they'll all become alcoholics.
Happily become alcoholics as they try all the wines. No, but I agree. I think a wine list needs to fit the resources of a restaurant. And so a big restaurant with lots of resources will have the resources to hire a sommelier. But most of the restaurants I like to go to are smaller, more intimate, and more casual. And as a result, I really expect those places to have smaller wine lists. That's not to say that it's going to compromise in any way on my experience, though. And the way they get around that is it takes work. They have to make their wine list very diverse, which takes knowledge in wine, so they have to educate themselves. But they also need to have a dynamic wine list, one that's constantly changing. So every time I come in, I might see a new wine that piques my interest and the servers know about it. And so that takes a lot of time every week for the owners or a dedicated server to be trying wines, figuring out which wines to buy in to replace old ones, educating the staff about them. And they're really, I'm more familiar with the Milwaukee market, but there's a handful of restaurants there that really take that time to make a dynamic and diverse wine list. And I'm sure there's plenty of places in Madison too who do that. But that's responsible wine list making, if you will.
Just thinking about it from a restaurant point of view, is wine sale, is that a Middle profit, high profit?
High profit.
High profit.
Yeah, it's where restaurants make their money for the most part. And as a result, you're going to have a higher markup, much higher markup than retail. And I think from the outside, a lot of people, they see a wine at the grocery store cost $10, and then they go to a restaurant and they see that it costs $30, and they become angry about it. And to some extent, I understand, but that is where they make their markup a lot of times. And it's not just giving you the bottle. Hopefully, if it's a good wine list, they've put a lot of resources in to make it an enjoyable, like, all-round experience. So you have to keep in mind you're paying for that experience, which the wine adds to at the end of the day.
Yeah. Talking with Jessica Bell today, founder and CEO of My Wine School, based in Chicago and Milwaukee. Great to have her along. Certainly looking forward to your questions and comments. Do you feel comfortable assessing a wine list? What would make you feel more at ease? Is there a Wisconsin restaurant that you feel has an excellent wine list? What about waitstaff who are especially helpful in choosing wines? Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I had a friend once who was with someone else who ordered a $1,000 bottle of wine in a restaurant here in Madison.
Wow.
And she said, you know what? She was so nervous about it, but she said it wasn't very good wine.
Well, I think there's so much room for disappointment at that price point. I worked as a sommelier in New York, and there was a little bit more money floating around. So we would have people who would come in and spend $500, $1,000 on a bottle of wine. And I don't say regularly, but, you know, at least once a week or a couple times a week, at least. And I think we would always try them. That was part of our service. Nice perk, right?
Mm-hmm.
but I think that it always left so much room for disappointment, because at that price point, you are expecting something to just knock your socks off. And really, the incremental difference in value and flavor from, say, $100 to $1,000 is not going to be worth, I think, in my book, $900. I think it's usually people are more likely to be disappointed than, whereas I think people get excited when they can buy a $30, $40, $50 bottle of wine in a restaurant and love it.
And know that they can probably go out and find it.
Exactly, and afford it.
When you look at a wine list, how are they generally organized?
Well, a lot of people do different things. I think most people in America are going to take one of a couple different approaches. In America, we tend to associate our wine with the grape. So we understand wine by Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah.
So obviously that's probably the first most common way of organizing a wine list is by grape. Others are going to use by region. Then others will do it by style. And then some people get more creative. There's lots of ways of approaching it apart from that. But I think those are the three major ways people look at a wine list. I would recommend that people go in knowing about how much they want to spend. I mean, that's true for anything you buy.
Sure.
You don't go in saying, I'm going to either spend $100 or $1,000. You know you're going to spend either $50 to $80 or $100 to $120. And that's already going to start to whittle down the list for you. Then you do red or white. Usually people know whether they want red or white. Again, that's going to really break down the list for you. And then at that point, you can do one of two things, I think. There are some areas which I know are known for value wines. Really hone in on those. So I say Spain, Chile, Argentina, Washington. Those are really crowd-pleasing, high-value wines. And so if you got the right color, the right price, and you're in those regions, you're probably going to get a good wine. I also tell people to just look at the vintages, not for a specific vintage, but for reds. You don't really, unless you really know the wine well, I don't think you want to buy one that's more than 5 to 6 years old and a white more than 3 to 4 years old. And that could even be on the back end of the range at that point. So vintages become only important for, say, $50 to $100 wines if they're too old. They've been sitting on the wine list for 6 or 7 years. You don't want to be drinking those. So that's the only place I think vintages really become important. Or if you're spending over $100, you're going to want to start to understand that, you know, this year in Burgundy was good or that year in Bordeaux was better.
Mm. So what happens to wine when it sits for 5 years? Or why does it go? It kind of goes bad, or at least it.
It never really,
goes bad.
Well, yeah, as long as it's not faulted, it's just on its way to vinegar, basically, right?
Okay.
So, yeah, as wine ages, you're eventually, if you got the right things added, you're going to get vinegar. But wine starts out with a certain level of intensity of flavor. And with age, that's going to go down. And the best wines will not only decrease in intensity, but the best wines will start to evolve. Most wines won't evolve very much. So you're just losing flavor. And so if it ages too long, first of all, you've got very little flavor, but alcohol and acid don't go anywhere. So now you just have a really hot from the alcohol and bitter, tart wine. So it just doesn't taste very good. And then you can also get oxidation, which is when oxygen comes into the wine, and that'll make a white wine taste like dried apples or sherry, and dried, red wines will taste like port or raisins. So, and that's not what the winemaker intended usually at that point.
I've had that experience.
Yes, I know. Well, that's what I tell people, wines by the glass. That's an interesting point because I think a lot of people, when they try wines by the glass, they don't realize that perhaps that bottle's been open for 2-3 days, maybe a week. So if you ever have a red wine that tastes like port or a white wine that tastes like sherry.
Been open too long.
ask him for a new glass, unless you want to drink port or sherry.
Jessica Bell, our guest. She's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Then we will be back with her. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, having a lot of fun today talking with my guest, Jessica Bell. She is the founder and CEO of My Wine School, based in Chicago and Milwaukee as well. And we'll talk with her a little about her organization, but we're talking about what makes a good wine list and talk about good wines with you, and you may have a question or comment, or maybe you've got an experience to share relating to wine, maybe in a restaurant or at home. I hope you'll join in with your comments or your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. How comfortable are you with a wine list? What would make you feel more at ease? Or maybe there's a Wisconsin restaurant that has a wine list you really like. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And maybe I should have asked this earlier, Jess, but talk a bit about My Wine School. Tell us about.
Sure. Yeah. So we do all kinds of wine education. We have been in Chicago and Milwaukee for the most part. Right now we've got wine tasting classes about once a month. We alluded to before, I've got two small kids now, so not as frequent as before. But we do have some fun tastings coming up this summer in June and July. So one's wines for the grill. So we'll be doing wines paired with all different types of brats. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, my sister has some pretty cool brats, including kimchi and beer brats and all these random but delicious combinations. And then we'll also be doing cheese and wine with actually Sarah Hill. I think from the Milk Marketing Board.
Yep.
She comes in and she brings anywhere from 8 to 10 cheeses. And we pair 6 wines with 8 to 10 artisanal Wisconsin cheeses. And it's always a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds great.
It is, yeah.
Do you ever do, I can't imagine this, but maybe wine brats instead of beer brats?
I've never tried it, but that's, now you've got me thinking. Now, this wine we have today would be great because it's got so much flavor and so much berry flavor to it that I think, I like that. I like how you're thinking. The problem is with some beer brats is if it's not a fully flavored beer, I don't get much of the beer flavor.
Yeah.
Do you?
No.
Yeah, and so you need like a pretty fully flavored beer. So this wine would actually... I'm gonna put that to my sister. Maybe that's what we'll do in June.
I love that idea.
Well, I did too.
Well, now you're going to have to tell me. You can write an article on it.
You bet.
You have an article that you wrote that has appeared in an issue of
M Magazine.
M Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about wine lists.
Right. Yeah. And I just talk about how wine lists, they don't have to be large to be good, where the onus lies on the falls on the restaurateur to make it an experience. And you can have a wine list of, I focused on five restaurants that have wine lists of about 50 or less wines, and they do a great job with it. In fact, as you mentioned to your listeners, I would love to know what restaurants they love for wine lists. And I think a lot of people think it has to be big for it to be a good one. And I disagree. Obviously, it's great to have a big wine list and great wine service. But I also think some of my best wine experiences have come from really dedicated, smaller restaurants.
Yeah. When you're thinking about, okay, what wine am I going to have? Or Well, there are different price ranges. I mean, what are the kind of the breakdowns in terms of price ranges? Where?
Yeah, I would say some restaurants don't even include the lowest, which is usually around, I think, 25 to 30 is about as low as you'll see on a restaurant wine list, up until, say, $40 to $50. Some higher-end restaurants won't even put those on. But that's probably the first tier of pricing. And then you've got something from about $50 to $80, and then $80 to $100, and then,
the $1,000 bottle here.
Exactly. And the it was interesting. The five restaurants I featured, all fantastic restaurants, there were four of them that actually had no wines over $100, and yet they had fantastic wine lists. And it's because they had dedicated professionals who constantly are tasting wines and looking for value wines. And in fact, they said that a lot of their wines on the higher end are their best priced wines, their best values, because they're pricing their wines to move. That seems to be a trend in some smaller restaurants, is they don't want a showpiece wine list. They want their diners to actually drink the wine. So at $100, technically you're getting a lot less of a markup at the $40 or $50 range, which can be true in a lot of places. If you go a little higher, the markup's less in terms of percentages.
Oh, okay. So if you're...
Because usually there's about like a 3 to 4 times, up to 4 times markup on wholesale prices. So they won't do that. Instead of doing 3 to 4 times, they'll just say, well, we'll just put a $30 markup, which would only be, say, 30%. Maybe almost close. I mean, that's retail at 30%, 30 to 40%.
We have, I've been in situations like this, frankly, quite a few times where... people are ordering different, there's four or six of you, six people pretty often with in our sort of crowd. And nobody ever orders this, there's no couple ordering the same dish.
Right.
So you have a whole variety of dishes and spices and whatnot. How do you order the wine when you got that kind of situation?
Yeah, I would say usually as long as everyone's okay with a red, I think what you can probably do is do a lighter bodied, lower tannin red. And so some wines that would fall in that camp would be a Pinot Noir or a Grenache. I think those are really food friendly reds because their tannins are low and they'll still go nicely with fish dishes. Or if you want to go with a white direction, you want to get more fuller bodied wines so Chardonnays, Viogniers, Marsans, those are all white wines that might do better. Or you could do what I do, is a sparkling wine. Wine, if your table's open to it, a sparkling wine is across the board. And even a dry rosé sparkling wine is a lot of fun. Especially with, the summer coming up, that's a great pick. It pleases the people who like fruity wines, but the people who like dry wines are going to like it too.
Yeah, and we almost never, I never think of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's such, rosé wines are fantastic food wines in that they take the best of both worlds of red and white wines.
Yeah.
And you can get sweeter ones if you want too, if that's your preference, but dry rosés are extremely food friendly.
I like that idea a lot. Let's take some calls. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. give us a call with your questions or comments, or would love to hear your experiences with wine as well in restaurants or at home. Greg in Janesville, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I apologize if you discussed this earlier, but my wife, when she goes into a liquor store to purchase wine, she looks at these ratings, and then she likes to go between $20 and $30. So she thinks if she gets a 90, between $20 and $30, we've had a lot of success with that. But my question is, how accurate are those ratings, and how are those ratings obtained?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think it's a great strategy, too. I don't think there's anything wrong with the strategy. The ratings were created, I think in the 1970s by a gentleman, Robert Parker, who came up with them because he was a lawyer and he was very academic. And so he thought, I'm going to rate my wines the way they rate my papers in law school on a 100-point scale. And so he was the first really to do this. And it was very successful. People identified with it. They said, 90 points. It didn't need any explaining. In one number, you knew what was happening. Then over the years, a number of other people and magazines have also started to use that. So it's become very accepted to do a 100-point scale. A couple of things to keep in mind. These are individuals who are tasting, and they should be wine professionals, meaning they should be able to separate their personal preference from quality. That said, It's difficult to do that. And I have a certain preference for wines. And when I taste that type of wine, I'm going to be more biased to like it. Yeah. I can still taste for quality. But one criticism of Robert Parker over the years is that he likes big, juicy, jammy red wines. So you would find on his scale, there would be maybe more of those wines that are getting the higher points. That said, I think it's a good starting point. It means someone else has tasted the wine before you. And that's more than you know for the other wines that don't have points. I caution people to not only use the ratings. I think what you want to do is think about the style of wine you like, and then the ratings is one place to go. But also don't dismiss a wine because it doesn't have a rating. Just because it hasn't been tasted by someone else doesn't mean it's not going to be up to par. But Greg, I think it's a great, you're getting one step closer to a higher quality wine knowing someone's tasted it and who should be a wine professional has marked it as a quality wine.
Hmm.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Do you ever look at tell us, I really want our listeners to know about your own background because you have an extensive...
I've drunk a lot of wine. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, you've done that. I wouldn't call you a wino. You're actually highly educated in this field.
I've spent a lot of time on it. I started professionally working in wine. I worked at a Spanish winery in Spain. And actually, I take a group every year. We're almost full on our trip for October. So we're taking a group of about 20 people all over Spanish wine country. And so that's where I got my start. And then moved back to New York City. I had been living there before that and worked as a sommelier at the Modern in New York City. And that's why I was listening to Bread and Butter and Michelle and you talk. And it brought back so many memories of this culture of fine dining. And it really is amazing. I realized they work very hard for them not to be detected. You know, like it's just right when you need something, they're there. But they do a lot of work to make sure that's how it is. And then I studied in New York and studied with the International Wine Center, got a high level of accreditation from accrediting body in London. And then I moved back here and started the wine school in 2006. So, and since then, I've become an accredited wine instructor for Burgundy, for the Rhone, for Provence, for Spain, for Napa Valley, whoever wants to accredit me, I'm willing to visit.
And earn that accreditation.
You got it.
That's wonderful. And my wine school itself doing well.
Yeah, we are. As I mentioned, I've got two small kids now, and so we're doing a bit less of the tastings in terms of frequency, but I'm still offering them. I'm not doing the accreditation courses I used to do, but I'm starting to write more, so we're doing some articles. I'm just always looking for ways to get the message out that wine is fun, it's approachable, there's plenty to learn if you want to learn about it, mm-hmm. but you really, I mean, you take it for what it is, and you enjoy it first and foremost, and then as far as you want to dive into it, I'm there to answer questions. But first and foremost, it's all about having some fun.
And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Look forward to hearing what you've got, an experience to share or a question. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Speaking of questions, when you're at the at a nice restaurant, what are good questions to ask a server to help choosing the best bottle for your taste and budget?
Yeah, I think the key thing is to be able to communicate what you like. And that's what I tend to teach people. So assimilate it to the experience of going and ordering coffee. When you go and you say, I want a skinny, frappy, foamy.
Whatever.
So the idea is to be able to go in and say, I'm looking for a light-bodied red wine with real crisp acidity and dry, let's say. Okay, so that will help the server, a very well-educated server, narrow down their wine list to be able to help you and say, okay, based on what you like, here are three or four wines that you might like. And also, don't be shy about indicating your price point. That's fully reasonable to say that you want to spend $50 and not $100. And it's the server should never make anyone feel little or insignificant if they want to spend less money. It's their job to find a wine that you like. So I think you've got to be able to talk to them about what you like and then communicate how much you want to spend. And hopefully, if the restaurant's done a good job, they've educated their servers, allowed the servers to try a lot of the wines, if not educate them about what the style is.
The descriptors for wine are interesting.
Yes. And they can be as black and white as talking about high acid, low acid, to something more artistic, talking about, I often use elegance and structured, and, people who are artists like to talk about it, and or musicians, high notes and low notes, or I often will talk about a wine and how pretty it is. And obviously those are very subjective. Hopefully they're rooted in some objective parameters like acid and body and tannin and sugar and how that all comes together. But we could really go all day over analyzing wine. But it's all about, I think what the problem is not a problem, but the good thing is there's so many wines out there that now that's why people are intimidated, because there's so much selection. It's people don't know where to start. And so I think where they need to start is start to understand what they like and be able to communicate that. And then lean on the people at the restaurants and the retail stores to help you with it.
We had an email from Jim in Mequon. It says, my niece, Melissa, is studying to become a sommelier. She loves giving me wines that I have no knowledge of. I don't know anything about. And
well, that's the fun part of sharing wine. I think people who really love wine just love sharing a bottle of wine.
She says she for Christmas she gave me a bottle of
Gigonda.
I expected a heavy European Pinot, but was surprised that it was mildly full body without the bite I get out of some European wines. Can you talk at all about
Gigonda
wines and suggest some that are available, please?
Sure, no problem. So Gigonda is in the south of France, and that is a place that I recommend people try, that region, south of France. Rhône is the larger area. So Gigonda is a small area within the Rhône. And the Rhône is a great place to start for French wines because there's a lot of sun, which means you're going to get a little bit of a softer, fruitier style. And people often complain that about French wines that they might be too austere or too thin or acidic. So start there. And Gigonda, Jim, is a great place to start. Now, the unfortunate thing is there aren't a lot of them available. I've been there. I've been certified. But it's a small region. It's beautiful, but it's very small. One that's more likely to be available just next door is called Châteauneuf du Pape, and it means the new chateau of the Pope. And actually, the Pope set up his chateau there back in the day. So Châteauneuf du Pape. Now, I will say Gigondas, though, is a better value. So if you can find it, definitely look for it. But
Gigondas, now, what would be a price range for that?
They can be as cheap as about 25. Okay. And they're probably going to go up to about 40 retail. So that's retail prices. So they're not cheap, but it is, it's made primarily from Grenache, which is, we were talking about it off air. Grenache is really becoming more popular. In Spain, it's Garnacha. In France, it's Grenache. And they're just soft, round, fuller bodied wines, like he mentioned. And I highly recommend checking out a Grenache or a Garnacha. But Gigondas, there's one place next door, if you can find it, to Gigondas and Châteauneuf du Pape called Vacara. And that's even a better deal because it's a little newer in terms of accreditation at this level. It's spelled VACQUEYRAS. Yes,
whoa,
that's why I had to spell it. But that one, if you can find that one will go down as low as just under 20 to about 40. And it's same area, same grapes, just a little newer to the scene, though.
Very cool. Well, Richard called and said that the best wine he ever tasted was in the 1950s in Morocco in a Greek restaurant, came in an unlabeled jug, and he has had nothing since that's come close to it. Well, now
I believe it. I think we have, there's great wines and then there's great wine experiences. And
yeah.
I mean, 1950s in Morocco in a Greek restaurant. How can you top that? Right? And I think it was probably a good wine too. But the thing is that's what the point of my article was, is that wine is one more opportunity to provide an experience to the diner. And we're sophisticated diners now. We expect experiences in addition to food. And Richard, that sounds like a fantastic experience. And I'm sure it was probably Northern African wine, which is great. In fact, they probably have Grenache down there too. I think it's everything.
Yeah.
Everything coming together creates
Morocco,
those experiences.
Man.
In the 50s, too.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Take us back.
Right.
Go back and
right,
sit,
take me.
Sit in that same Greek restaurant.
Right.
Oh, my goodness me. Oh, that would be a lot of fun. That would be a lot of fun. Well, we have, we have some more callers. How do you, Nick has a good question, and let's see if we can get Nick on here. Nick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I just had a simple question of where would one begin if they wanted to start to educate themselves more about differences in wines?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think what's really important to do is drink wine, but not only drink it, but start making mental notes of it, and even physical notes help very much, is to actually start bookmarking these concepts of is there fruit? Is there spice? Is there is it acid? Is there high acid or low acid? And that's where an intro class really comes into play, is that introduction of those terms and what they feel like and what they mean. I will say, don't get frustrated, though, because that process of practice takes a long time to fine tune. But if you use every opportunity of opening a bottle of wine as that ability to practice, I mean, this is the most fun practice you'll have, Nick. But if you use that, you're going to get better and better and start to realize, oh, you know what? I like this wine better than last night's wine because the acid's a little lower. And the acid just, you know, is how acidic or tart a wine feels. But that's one thing you can do.
Jessica, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We have links to Jessica's sites. She's got some wonderful information up on those sites, and I hope you will take advantage of them. Jessica Bell from My Wine School. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.